Hello. Welcome to the photo show. Yeah, your eyes don't deceive you. We are definitely here. We are definitely broadcasting. How long will we do? I don't know. But as with all the usual stuff, it's about time and being able to do it. But I've got to say a huge thank you to Ian Lewis, because he's been one of the people who's instrumental in helping me get the show up on the road again. We've now got Apple, now they've done collaboration in Pages, of course. The Pages document is updated weekly by both of us, so we can add things to it. And we've done one yesterday, which worked pretty well. And that's going to carry on, I think. So as long as I've got time to sit and record, we're doing it at 11 o'clock on a Thursday morning. I'll try and do it on 11 o'clock on a Thursday, because that's kind of a regular time, or maybe we'll push it back a little bit, go to the 12 or 1 o'clock break. But we'll try and keep it there, but I'll do it whenever I possibly can. The format will also change as well. So on weeks where I haven't got time to do a show, we're going to try and record some special episodes and keep those in the vault and then throw those up when I'm not around. But thanks to Ian for doing it. He's going to make a world of difference for us. And thanks to all the people that have written as well, saying, oh, when's the photo show coming back? Why aren't you podcasting about what you do for a living? That seems ridiculous. And it does seem ridiculous. I totally agree. So it's changed. I'm going to try and keep this going as long as I possibly can. It's just the workload should have decreased a bit, thanks to Ian. So cheers, Ian. You're a great mate. I do appreciate it. Matt is in and out of the chat room as well. LJP's been in and out of the chat room. I guess Colloquy's playing up. Right, here we go then. Start us off. The news. So first up is a story that's out of Moscow. This is a guy, or this is a photo of one of the images of a guy called Jock Sturgis. He's had his exhibition closed in Moscow. He's an American photographer. And the reason it's been closed is because protesters threw urine on the pictures, which I'm sure they're behind glass, so it doesn't make much difference. But it's caused a bit of controversy. And one of the pro-Kremlin senators said that they were depicting child abuse in the images. The images are effectively pictures of children and girls. It's called No Shame is the exhibition, and it's images of families that were taken over a period of decades. So you can see the children growing up, you can see the adults changing their physical form. It's an all-nude shoot though, so there is no nothing left to the imagination as that, but it's not pornographic or anything, don't get me wrong. But it's all models were consenting. There was consent of parents for children when they were children, and there's consent of the children as they've become adults as well. As so he's not done anything wrong here. It's just caused a lot of controversy in Russia. Sturgis has been here before though. He's not a stranger to controversy. In fact, one page I read describes him as a lightning rod for controversy. He conducts it to himself, apparently. His brand of nude photography has always caused issues for him when he's been back in his home United States, and it's not left him now. He's trying to do it abroad as well. As so the exhibition was at the Lumiere Brothers Gallery in Moscow, and it remains closed for the foreseeable future. It will not change. One of the things that was quite interesting, though, is that it spawned a group of people who I thought were quite interesting. These are them on the picture. There's 12 of these guys, all in coats that are the same, with badges on that are the same. It's kind of a pseudo uniform. And they are called the Officers of Russia. There you go. And the officers of Russia are appear to be, from what I can see, just a public vigilante group who decide when things go and when they don't. They do look like fairly normal people, though, so it's not like an anarchist group from far left or far right or something like that. If they're genuine people who seem concerned about the welfare of the country and they're trying to do something about it, then I suppose fair enough. But vigilantes never do well, do they? No vigilante groups, please. Certainly. Do you want to feed some starving children? Because you can. Here's the way to do it. There is a firm who started up a webpage, Delete to Feed. It's just as it says, deletetofeed.com. All you have to do is, if you're on Instagram, go to this website and sign up with them and pledge through your Instagram account. You have to give them access to your Instagram account. That's my doorbell. You have to give them access to your Instagram account for the purposes of actually knowing that you've deleted something, but go through all the pictures of food that you've taken and posted up on Instagram and delete it. And every time you delete one of those images, then Delete to Feed will give 11 meals to starving children in the US. Costs you nothing, takes no time on your part, and a kid will get a meal. Plain and simple. One in six kids in the US may not know where their next meal is coming from, says their press release. You can make a difference, turn your food posts into real meals, and help spread the word. This is going on until mid-October, or whenever the company Land O'Lakes reaches 2.75 million donated meals, okay? So it's dead good cause, well worth doing, and it's brilliant. And the thing is as well, even if you just don't, if it's not a picture of food, the program apparently doesn't know if you're deleting food or not. So just delete any of your images and they get it. So just take an image and then delete it and they still get 11 meals given out to kids. Plain and simple. Good cause. That'll do. Adam says, what a lovely system they've made. We'll have to do this for myself to help out. There we go. It's well worth doing. Please look after them. Now, you know, we've always gone on about, you know, the super zooms and those kind of things with the great big long lenses and how difficult it is. You know, it's 1200 millimeters of zoom on this bridge camera or something like that. And it's all well and good, but trying to hold it steady is a real pain in the butt. Image stabilization helps, and there's lens stabilization as well as. And also having a good hand or putting it on a tripod or anything like that is also brilliant. But your measurement of how stable you can be is measured in the number of stops that you can accommodate. So, you know, if you've shot it at f2.8 and you set the thing down, effectively you could be getting as much stabilization as if you were at how many stops along the line from that. Okay, so in an interesting interview that was done with Amateur Camera, someone at Olympus has let slip, I've got the name of the bloke here somewhere, I can't find it, Setsuya. There you go, Setsuya, whoever he is. He said they've got a new stabilization system. So they've managed to peak the maximum degree of image stabilization that you can achieve without stopping the Earth from turning. Because apparently the Earth turning is actually what causes the real problem when you get to the high end of image stabilization. The limit is apparently 6.5 stops of compensation. Then after that, you're limited by the gyros that are in the stabilization system because the gyros get frigged with by the movement of the Earth, and that's as far as you can go. So after that, the Coriolis effect, I guess, and something like that maybe for the image stabilization kicks in. Deputy Division Manager Setsuya Katakawa, I've said that wrong probably, do apologise, when he was asked about the incredible Olympus Sync IS system that combines in-lens and in-body stabilisation to record 6.5 stops of shape reduction, he said the in-body stabilisation itself gives 5.5 stops and the Sync IS system gives 6.5 with the OIS lens added to it. So 6.5 stops, we've worked out, is actually a theoretical limitation at the moment due to the rotation of the Earth interfering with the gyro sensors. So if you want to go any further than that, you're going to have to come up with a completely new system and start beating physics, it would look like. The camera that they put it on is the Olympus E Mark 1, the Olympus E M1 Mark 2. Which has got no dose release and no price point yet. But we'll talk about it later because we're going to review that in the gear stuff. But it was dead interesting to read how that we've actually got a problem with stabilization of images due to rotation of the Earth. Oh, that's quite interesting. There we go. If you're saying, oh, this is a great story, Ewan, thanks very much, mate, where can we get a hold of them? We are going to do show notes for this. Because we're making a document, it makes it far easier to do show notes. So the document that I've got all the stories listed on with the links to them and the images and that kind of stuff, we will put that in the show notes. It'll go to a PDF document and all the links will be in that PDF document. You just click on the link in the summary, if you like, of the posting on the website at britishtechnetwork.com/photo and you will get everything that I've read out. There you go. It's the only show with show notes on BTN because the rest were crap. The next story is quite an interesting one because this is two things. I mean, it's typical of our age in terms of the way that we've come to shoot photographs and that kind of stuff. But it's also quite interesting, and kudos to Hillary that she was the one that instigated it. It's Hillary Clinton. She's at an event in Orlando and she gets everyone that's there to take a picture. And she walks out into this thing. So these people are in an overflow room, so they haven't got to see her speak in the main hall. So she's taken the time to come out and talk to them directly on a microphone. Well done, Hillary. And she stands on a box so they can all see her. And then she says, why don't you all take a selfie? So she instigates it. And they all turn around and they all take a picture of themselves with Hillary Clinton waving in the background. Well done. What's kind of interesting is that you've got to give respect to Hillary, as it was her that said, let's take a group selfie shot. And okay, yeah, you might say, well, it's just PR, isn't it? It's just her putting a spin on it. But if you're going to have this woman as the president, at least she knows what a selfie is. That's not a bad start, is it? She's nousy enough to know what the people are doing out there. So that's a good thing for a politician to have. So I'm not going to knock it. Well done, Hillary. Job well done. Last story in the news stuff is quite nice, actually. I've always thought Tom Hanks was a bit of a decent bloke. Every time I see an interview, he comes across really, really well. He doesn't come across as arrogant. He comes across as a bit of a nice chap. So Ryan and Elizabeth are getting married in Central Park. And they're having their pictures taken on a piece of paved area. And, of course, they're going to get people walking past and gate crashing their images. But none other than Tom Hanks gatecrashed their images. He walked past, he spent a few moments congratulating the bride and groom. He also managed to kiss the bride's hand. Very gallant, well done, Tom. Took a selfie with them as well, and then promptly posted it up on Instagram. And he can delete that and give 11 meals to kids. So there you go, straight away. Well done, Tom. He's put copyright on it as well, which I thought was quite interesting. But well done, Tom. Nice thing to do. Something for them to remember. And the photographer, Meg Miller, hasn't done any harm herself. She's had no end of likes on Instagram and Twitter and that kind of stuff. So I'm sure her business is booming. We'll cut her some slack for cutting the feet off one of the shots because it would have been an exciting moment. Well done to her, though. Big kudos for actually not dropping the camera and going, oh, wow, and actually carrying on shooting. Total pro girl. Well done. The other thing I want to point out is if there's a video on the page where I looked at it and the video's been shot by someone from a member of the family or something like that, I'm guessing, and it was shot in landscape, not portrait. Top job. Well done, member of the family. There you go. Those are the basic news stories. We'll do more next week as we get along. We're going to try and keep it to 5 news stories, 5 gear stories and 3 questions. And then we've got a chance of actually fulfilling that rather than having like 7 or 8 or 9 like we used to have in the past. But we are going to have show notes. We are going to have questions as normal. If you've got a question, you can send it in to us at britishtechnetwork@gmail.com and we'll answer it. There you go. So it's time for the gear. Gear. There's been a bit of a domination of gear stuff this morning this week with the drones type stuff. We've got one camera story at the end, which is the Olympus that we talked about earlier on, and we've also got one on story on SD cards. But we've got to start off because this was the week of the release of the new GoPros. So you've got GoPro Hero 5 and you've got GoPro Hero 5 Session. As well as, so now, which is quite interesting, if you go to GoPro, before you had always had the Hero 4, and then you had Hero 4 Black, Hero 4 Silver, all that kind of stuff. From what I can look at, looking at the website, it's just one GoPro now. They've got away with all that stuff of separation and that kind of thing, which is quite interesting. They've gone for start off then the Hero 5. This is it's kind of a nice upgrade to what you currently had. It's got good image quality. It doesn't really push the bounds an awful lot further, I don't think, at the 4K end than the Hero 4 did. Certainly Hero 4 Black I had was pretty good. What's kind of interesting is that the Hero 4 Black cost me like £450, and I've got 3 of them that I use out at work when I'm out on site. This thing is one unit, does all of the stuff that the Hero 4 does, and it's £349. So it's £100 saving, and it's the new model. So well done, GoPro. Kudos there. The battery life, well, that's always been an issue. The Hero 2, I thought, had really good battery life. You'd get an hour to an hour and 20 minutes out of one of those batteries quite comfortably. When you went to the 3, it started to really suffer. You were down to 40 minutes, maybe an hour if you were pushing it. Certainly in cold weather, I got down into the 40s and 30s. And I have to say, the Hero 4, I've had some horror stories with that battery. I mean, sometimes it would last 40 minutes, other times it would only last 20 minutes. This is actually a bigger casing. So I'm hoping that they've listened to people going, your battery life sucks, mate, and they've thought about it and done something. Here's a comparison of the two. This was posted up on Mashable. Thanks to them for letting me steal the image. I do apologise. But there's the 4 and the 5 side by side. Now, it's not an awful lot, but you've got 3 or 4 mil there of extra depth, and you've actually got 3 or 4 mil of extra width. So that's quite a lot. It's got a screen in the back, so that'll have taken some of it up. But you always had the screen in the silver, didn't you? And it still had the same battery capacity. So I'm hoping they've boosted the battery compartment. That would be really, really cool. But I have my doubts. I'm going to hold my breath. I haven't seen any reviews yet. But I haven't. Hopefully, there's going to be some reviews out there that say that the battery life's really improved. But that could be the big fall. I do like the fact that they've ditched the multi-SKUs, having a main pro, then session, and then the Karma is a good and simple lineup of products. I agree with that, says Adam. And F. Hanshaw says, yeah, I've mainly seen ads for the main lines, Hero, Session, etc. Nothing else. Definitely the 5 is looking like it's a good upgrade. One of the things is that is the case that it comes in. That is the camera that you can see there on the Mashable shot. It's then got to go into a housing. So you're going, oh, hang on a second, so that's not good because that's even bulkier now. Yeah, okay, so your old housings aren't going to fit that. And GoPro have been really good about that kind of stuff. The 3 and the 4 had compatibility in the housings. This one's not going to fit in those because effectively it's the same size as an existing housing. What's nice, though, is that this model is waterproof. Now, I haven't actually got an IPX rating for this, but they're talking waterproof to 30 metres. Which I think is really cool, because that's where you're going to go diving and that kind of stuff, isn't it? So top job. Well done, GoPro. I don't have a problem with that, because the housings have dropped in price. There's going to be third-party housings out there that are going to be really, really cheap. And now what you've actually got is a skeleton housing. The thing that is nice is the fact that the toll 3-prong, 2-prong interlink that you've got for going into all your fixings that you already bought for all the other cameras is still there. So all of those are still compatible. So well done, GoPro, for keeping that compatibility. I actually really like it. You know, I've still got 4 Hero 3s and 3 pluses, 4 Hero 3 pluses and 4 Hero 3 Hero 4s. So, you know, I don't need another GoPro at the moment, but I seriously would think about if I lost one of those or I got it broken, I'd go for one of these. I think I wouldn't mess around looking for a cheaper version of an old one down on the back, which I used to do. Other things that are nice, it's got voice control. It doesn't actually explain what the voice control allows it to do, but if it's just simply start and stop recording, that would be really quite cool, because, you know, when you want to do selfies and that kind of stuff, it would be really good if you could tell it to take a picture as opposed to having to stand there and push the button, because there was no timer on the old stuff. It's got auto-upload to the cloud. Now, I thought this was dead interesting. I think you're going to have a MiFi or a link to a phone or something like that. But if it's taking pictures, it can just send them straight up to your iCloud stuff. Well, don't mean it's iCloud, cloud, whatever that is, whether it's Dropbox or iCloud or some other proprietary service that then they'll offer you. I think that's quite interesting, because certainly if you want to leave one out overnight or something like that and you want the images to be secure, you're worried about things being stolen, if it's pushing it straight up to the cloud, that would be really good. I work in tube stations quite a lot, and I get the Wi-Fi there from Virgin, and it would be cool if I could tie this to that and then I could just shoot images straight back up into the cloud and they'd be protected. That would be awesome. I need to read up on that a little bit more. It's got a touch display on the back as standard, so before you had that on the silver, but you didn't have it on the black. And it's got RAW and wide dynamic range photography support as well. So this thing's shooting RAW images when you're shooting stills. So if you do a time-lapse, you could be getting a whole set of time-lapsed stills that are RAW images that you could batch convert to get your exposures right, and then you could put into a sequencing program. Well done. I think it's a really, really good upgrade. And at £349, I think they're not taking the mickey with it. They've done good on the pricing. And that's also as well the pounds price. So that's what you buy in the UK store. So, you know, the Brexit stuff that's, you know, for exchange rate and that kind of thing, they haven't taken advantage on that. Well done. The other thing that we've got is the Hero 5 Session. Excuse me. So the Hero 5 Session is... it looks exactly the same as the previous Session camera that you've got beforehand. Hanjo in the chat room saying, yeah, that's pretty much it on the voice. It only does take photo, not take photo. I'll have to have another read up on that stuff. I only looked at this yesterday. The Hero 5 Session is £250. Now, the old session is still out there if you still want one. They're only £180. But the session at 250 is pretty good. If you want a cycle camera helmet, not bad at all. Don't know what the video life, the battery life on these things is like, though. I'm guessing it's going to be probably 20 to 30 minutes at most. So they might not be the right thing to have for a complete ride. This thing will add video stabilization. I forgot to say as well that there's video stabilization in the Hero 5 too. And also there's voice control as well. It does 90 frames per second at 1080, which is pretty impressive. And it does auto upload to the cloud as well as of your 1080p video. Top job. Well done. Good price, and it looks nice as well. I like the sessions. I like the small size of the sessions. It's just battery life that puts me off them, because you know the battery life's crap enough on the four I've got. If I can justify to myself why I need to buy a 5, I'll buy a 5, and then I'll have a go at it, and I'll see what it's like, and I'll see what the battery's like. But send me a donation, and then I'll do it on Patreon. Patreon.com/British Tech Network. Send us a donation, and I'll buy a 5 and test it for you. How's that? No? Okay. Next thing up on the news is the Karma. So there's two new drones out. There's one from DJI, and there's this one from GoPro. Now, I was a bit annoyed because the Karma videos that they put out that were showing how good it was were definitely not shot on it. They were boomed. I've seen a boom shot in my time a few times, and I noticed that they were not flown. So I'm sorry. That was a bit of BS. But when it came out, I was actually kind of impressed with it. It looks like a good little unit. It folds down into a backpack. Now, the backpack's not small, but the unit itself isn't huge either. It's certainly something that you'd carry around. It's about the size of a briefcase, I'm guessing. But it comes with back straps and it comes with a carrying handle. And the thing that really struck me that was nice about the Karma is the fact that, number one, you've got compatibility with the old models. So this thing is compatible with the Hero 5 Session, and it's also compatible with your old 4 as well. Now, that's important. I don't think it'll go back to the 3 because I think it's to do with comms information back through from the transmitters that give you the images back when you fly in the thing. But the other thing that I thought was quite impressive was that the gimbal on the front there, that's got to deal with 3 different cameras at 3 different sizes and 3 different weights. And that's pretty impressive because I know how hard it is to stabilize a gimbal when you've got something that's a completely different size too. You have to go through all the PID settings in it to get it to go absolutely right. And that's really, really impressive. I'm sure there's a preset, don't get me wrong, but it's well worth plussing them up for that. Apparently, it's easy to fly. Now, that's in inverted commas because I have no clue what easy to fly really means. It's got to be more than just simply control it. It's got very limited controls, as you can see there on the hand. There's only the 2 dials to the left and the right. There's a home button on there as well, so you press it and the thing will just come straight back to the handset. And there's also a power switch, so you can kill the power remotely if you really need to. Adam's in the chat room saying, as much as I support GoPro, I think DJI completely trumped them with the Mavic Pro. I watched a couple of videos yesterday about the Mavic Pro, and I'm not so sure that they have. But still unsure on drone laws, though, says Lee, although he wants one. Drone laws are actually fairly simple. You're allowed to have one of these. There's no problem. You can be a hobbyist and you can have this. If you've got a drone, just a plain drone, and you want to fly it around, then you can't go within 50 meters of a person who's not under your control or with their permission, and you can't go within 50 meters of a structure that is not in the control of you or without permission. Simple as that, and that's it. There are D-shaped zones that are around the ends of airports, and you can't fly any drones within those D-shaped zones, absolutely. So look where your nearest airport is. If you go to the CAA, you can see these D-shaped areas that allow you to fly. If you've got a camera on it, it changes completely. You can't go within 150 meters of a structure that you don't have control or permission from, and you can't go within 150 meters of a person that you don't have control of or permission from. Plain and simple, that's it. As a hobbyist though, Providing you stick to that criteria, you can fly your drone as much as you like. There's no issue with it at all. So if you go for a country walk and you're out in the park and you're by yourself and there's no one around and you stick your drone up and it flies around, you does some orbits and that kind of stuff while you're walking along or riding your bike, no worries at all with that. No problem whatsoever. You just can't do it in those D zones or within 150 metres if there's a camera on it, 50 metres if there isn't. Simple as that. That is the simplicity of the law as it stands at the moment. You want to do it professionally, different thing entirely. You need a permission from the CAA. You've got to go on a course, which will cost you a couple of grand, and then you've got to get your unit flight tested, so it's got to have a CE mark. You can't build your own without putting the CE mark on it yourself or getting someone else to do it for you. You've got to have a flight log, you've got to talk about failures, you've got to record what those failures are, you've got to treat it like a small aircraft, up to 7.5 kilos, over 7.5 kilos, holy moly, you don't want to get into that. There you go, Lee. That is the line on the line. And I know because I spoke to a really nice man at the CAA. If you ring the CAA up and ask him for questions, there's a bloke there that deals with the drone stuff. He's brilliant. He's really, really good. Really helpful. Not negative at all. And the other thing that I found as well, I said, oh, what about if I fly indoors? Because CAA don't control indoor airspace. He says, yeah, we control all airspace, indoor or out. So if you fly it professionally in a building, you still need a permission for us because we control the airspace in the building for aircraft. Damn. No loopholes there then. This thing packs down pretty well. It's supposedly easy to fly. It doesn't say that they've got any anti-collision stuff or any altitude markers or that kind of stuff or optical sensors for collision or optical sensors for landing. It does have a return to home thing. That's all. There is a large touchscreen and it isn't bad actually. I've had a look at the video for this and it does look rather nice. There's a couple of extra controls on it that you can see at the front and the side for zooming the camera. You get a live feedback of what the camera's seeing and it looks great. I don't think it's a real problem. Apparently it's got good resilience in wind. I looked at one of the videos and the guy was flying it in quite a gusty wind, up to 20 miles to 30 miles per hour gusts. And he said it was rock solid. It hardly moved at all. The screen that you've got on the front is touchscreen as well. So you can change mode. You can get it to orbits. You can get it follow you or do all that kind of stuff that you can do with Lily. And I think actually that there's a real problem because I put myself down for a Lily and I'm going to cancel my order because this does everything that a Lily does. It gives you far more flexibility. It's only £200 more than the Lily is. And the Lily, I just think they've waited too long. I think they're gonna really seriously fall out of the sky, excuse the pun, because they've waited far too long to release it. So what do you get in that? Well, one of the other things that's really nice is that it uses your existing cameras. So you're going to know the quality of the camera before you get out there and use it. And I've looked at a couple of the Mavic camera shots. And they don't look very good at all. Even when I watched them on full resolution on YouTube, I didn't think they were that good a quality, whereas I know my Hero 4 stuff looks brilliant. The other thing that's really cool is that in the center there, you've got the gimbal that's held by the body. Well, if you want to use the gimbal not on the camera, it just slides out and turns into a handheld gimbal straight away. There's nothing to add onto that. That whole thing slides into the body of the drone. So you can fly it around without the camera if you want on it, or you can pull this thing out and you can then use it as a handheld gimbal, which, I mean, those things are 250 quid a piece as it is. So you're getting a drone and you're getting a gimbal for the drone and you're getting a handheld gimbal for the drone. There is no camera on it. And if you want to buy it in the UK, it is the grand old price of £719. I think that's probably about right. I don't think there's a real problem with that. I think that's really good, keenly priced. There's no camera on it, but lots of people have already got a GoPro. So if you've got a GoPro 5 or a GoPro 4, then you're laughing anyway. I have, certainly. So I haven't got that expense. It's £200 more than, and I can use the handheld gimbal commercially for work because I've got one that I use already here that's on its last legs, really. So I think I could probably justify that as a work expense, most definitely. I think it's a good price. I think it's well done and I like it. The other one that came out is the Mavic. There's not as many pictures out there of the Mavic. This is from DJI. You know, if you're GoPro, you're sitting there going, oh, I just thought that I got the market cornered with my GoPro. And then DJI have released this thing, the Mavic. It's smaller. That packs down to the surface area of an iPhone 7 Plus pretty much. So it really is tiny. The controller's way tiny. It's got a smaller screen on it. It doesn't look bad at all. This thing has advanced hand gesture features. So if you put your hands in front of your face like you're holding a camera, this thing knows that it's supposed to focus on you. And apparently there's a hand gesture to get it to take a picture as well as, which is pretty good. They've also got live streaming from video. That will stream 720p video back to your handset. And according to them, they will stream it up to 4.3 miles away. That's 7 kilometres. Now, you're going, oh, that'd be fantastic. I'd shoot loads of stuff with that and just sit in my back garden. No, you can't, because the CAA rules say you've got to have a 500-metre limit from the handset, and you must remain in visual sight of your drone when it gets to its limit of movement. And this is the one thing that I think sets it apart from the Karma. The Karma's big, and it's got big flashing lights on it, and you can see it for quite some distance. If this thing's the size of an iPhone 7 Plus, go and stick your iPhone 7 Plus at the bottom end of the garden and see how easily you can see it, because you probably can't. So that actually means the effective range of this thing is about to fly in a park, and that's it, with your kids. And of course, the park is full of other people's children, so you can't fly it because you're within 150 metres of them and you've got a camera on it. I think this is really quite limited if people actually stick to the law. If they don't stick to the law, wow, fantastic. You go out into the middle of nowhere and start flying this thing in a country that didn't give a stuff about whether you're watching it or not, then fine, you're going to enjoy yourself. But all of these things are great, but you can't use them in the UK. You must remain with line of sight to your aircraft, and that's absolute whether you're a hobbyist or not. It's $1,000, and there's no delivery to the UK at the moment, so God knows what price it's going to be when it gets here as well as. I'd justify that in a heartbeat. Smock says 150 metres from anyone else in the park is tricky. What happens if someone walks into the radius? Then you've got to stop using it. And if you're in a busy park, you shouldn't be using it at all. Thanks to Bronwyn. She's put a link in the chat room on the Flying Aircraft and Ownership Jones Practices for America, I'm guessing that, the AOPA.org. You shouldn't be flying it in a park, effectively. If you add those factors all together and you have a look at it and you think about it, to be honest, I think the Karma wins, because I think it's more usable. You've got the backpack to carry it around. You can see it for greater distances, so it's far easier. It's still got the orbit cam and all that kind of stuff that can go with it. It does everything that the Lily does, so I'd rather cancel me Lily at $599, pay the extra 100 quid and have the Karma. I don't want the Mavic, because it does loads of great stuff, don't get me wrong, but the fact that it's so small, I think, you could be dangerous. At the point you can't see where this thing has gone, it's dangerous. I got one of those little tiny ones years ago, the Hoobsan ones, and I flew it up, and I thought, I wonder how far I can see it, and it was gone before, and I've lost it, because it flew away, because I couldn't see it. I just lost it against the sky in an instant. They're not easy to see once they get moving. So have a think carefully. Olympus have released a new camera. This is it. It is the OMD, the OM-D EM1 Mark II. There you go. That's it. It's got an electronic, this is the best bit, I love this bit. It's got an electronic shutter. So what it means is that with locked autofocus in burst mode, it can shoot 60 stills a second. Yeah, you heard me right, 60 stills a second. If you've got it on autofocus, so it's a continuous tracking autofocus, and it's not locked focus, then it can do 30 stills a second, which is really impressive. Both of those are JPEGs, by the way, let's not be silly. But if you want to shoot RAW, it can still do 18 images a second in RAW mode. That's pretty cool, isn't it? I really like that. I think that's a great idea. They call it, they've got a thing called professional mode as well, which I think is really interesting. So I spent years trying to work out where to take a picture of someone when they're swinging a bat, when they're doing different things, different activities, so that I knew when to capture them in the right position. This thing, when you press in RAW mode and you press the shutter down to take a single picture, in the time that it takes you to actually press and undo the shutter mechanism, the camera will have shot 14 frames. So you've only got to be loosely right, and you've got 14 raw images there to choose for your perfect moment of when little Johnny swung the bat at his little league game or something like that, or kicked the ball into the net at the football match. 20.4 megapixel sensor, that shoots all of those at that full level. It's got a quad core processor inside it, which is not surprising based on the fact it's doing all that processing. Olympus claims is 3.5 times faster than the previous processor that they used, a quad core TruePic 8 image processor. Shoots 4K video, you wouldn't be surprised. And it's micro four thirds, of course, because it's Olympus, which means that you've got great compatibility of lenses. And the lenses should be, in inverted commas, an awful lot cheaper. I really like the look of that. I think it looks really nice as a camera. And the speed of that shutter is just unbelievable. Adam's put in the chat, and blimey, that's one of the cameras can shoot that quick. Would it swing me from a Sony, though? I'm unsure. I'd like to see how it compares speed-wise to the A92. It's going to strip the guts out of the A99, mate. It's not even close. Not even close at those kind of speeds. Price? No idea. Due date? No idea. It's like CES all over again. Don't know when it's coming. Don't know how much it's going to be. So we'll have to wait and see. Those kind of things, you could push $2,000, I suppose. You could probably push $2,000 on that and get away with it. Last story. Thanks very much, Ian, for sticking this one in the chat. Where's it gone? There we go. This is a 1 terabyte SanDisk Extreme Pro XDSC card, and it's brilliant. You can currently buy a 512 gig version of this card, but that's £300. So God knows how much this is. I'm hoping this would be really nice if the 1 terabyte comes out at £300, and then that means that the 512 drops down to about 100, 150 quid. That'd be really, really cool. You'd have these for your video shooters. So at the moment I shoot on SD cards, and I've got some 256s for my, I've got one here, haven't I? No, I haven't. I've got some 256s that I use in my Sony FS5, and they're brilliant. They're really, really fast. There's no issues shooting, and the quality's excellent, and they feel really dependable. Question that you've got to ask yourself is, are you happy at going to a 1 terabyte single disc and worrying about whether it's going to wipe your data or crash or fall over? And I don't think I am. And basically, Adam's put in the chat room exactly what I'm thinking. As much as I trust SanDisk, I'd worry trusting 1 terabyte's worth of content on an SD card. The most I'd go to is 256, as you have, Ewan. I don't know. SanDisk, I've never had a SanDisk fall over. The stuff that's fallen over has always been other brand. Kingston fell over. I had two of those that both fell over. And I had some other ones that were Lexmar, and they fell over. And I was really surprised at that, because Lexmar stuff's usually really good. I've never had a SanDisk fall over yet, touch wood. I'm sure it's going to at some point, but there you go. Even if you've got a 50 megabyte RAW file, would you risk storing them on a 1 terabyte card, says Ian in the bit that he's put in the dock. Really, really good question. That's a lot of data to store in one place, and 1 terabyte of video. I mean, I go out on an entire weekend shooting for a customer, and I probably shoot at the most 300 gig, and that's it. And that's full HD video or 4K video, and there's some slow-mo stuff in there, and I'd never get close to that amount of data. I don't know that you'd ever fill it. So there you go. You know, you're certainly not going to fill it with stills, even at 50 megapixels or more. Not worth it. That was the gear. So next time, for your questions. If you've got a question, you can send it to us at britishtechnetwork@gmail.com. I've had a scout around of people that I know listen to the show, and I've sent them emails saying, oh, do you want to send us a question? Because obviously we haven't been on for a while, so people have stopped sending the questions in. We are back again now, so if you want a question answered about anything to do with photography, if I can answer it, I'll answer it. If not, I'll try and point you to where you can. Send it in. And that's it. First one I got's from someone called Ian, not Ian Lewis. And he's put, Ewan, I noticed that you've been saying that you've gone lock, stock and barrel into Sony a few weeks ago. And I was wondering how you're getting on. Is it a positive move? How expensive was it? And I hope the photo show can come back soon. Well, it's back. Here you go, Ian. Thank you very much, mate. I've gone from Sony. So basically, I've been a Canon man. I've been a Canon man since I can remember, since I started doing this back when I was 17. I've always had a Canon. I've got lenses that go along with that. I've probably got accumulated value about £20,000 worth of lenses, maybe a bit more. And I bought an FS5 because I wanted to carry a video camera around, not a stills camera that could shoot video. It was becoming cumbersome. I didn't like the kind of orientation of that kind of T of having the body. It made it very difficult to swing it around and use it. So I went for an FS5, which is a custom, you know, proper made video camera. I've been blown away by that. I absolutely love the Sony FS5. It shoots 4K video. It does 200 frames a second if I really want it to, and at full 1080p. And the quality of the video that comes out of it is brilliant. And the file system it uses, I hate AVCHD. It's just cumbersome to use in Final Cut. This thing produces an MTS file though, and the MTS file can be dragged and dropped straight into Final Cut. The only thing that I have to do is remember to take the thumbnails out and drop the thumbnails in with the MTS files, because that gives me a clue about what's in each MTS file. But it works really well now. I've got the workflow down to an absolute T. I love it. I absolutely love it. I have a dual strap that I put over me that holds the FS5 on one side and then a stills camera on the other side. The problem I had was I was carrying around a Canon camera and the FS5, and I was also carrying around two sets of lenses. So I'd have a 200mm lens to go on the stills camera, a 24-70 and a 16-35, and that was kind of my lens coverage, if you like. I never go beyond 200, it's just not worth it. And then on the FS5, I had a 105 lens, which I think it goes from 18 to 105, something like that. Really, really good lens with an autofocus, an auto zoom stuff on it. And I thought to myself, well, this is ridiculous. I might as well get myself some lens that I can swap out onto the FS5, and then I can use a Sony camera and use the other E-mount lenses. So I went out and I bought a 200mm E-mount lens, 16-35mm E-mount lens, and a 24-70 E-mount lens. And I bought the G-series on the 24-70. That cost me nearly £2,000. But they're beautiful lenses. They're really, really gorgeous. And then I've struggled to get a body because, of course, there was an earthquake and a lot of the stocks dwindled. But I managed to get hold of the 12-megapixel, the night time, the super low light version of the A7S II, and I've used that, and the pictures are great. The pictures are really, really great. They are small. They're only 12 megapixels, admittedly, but when you've done interpolation, I've sent them through to the people that make like the signs for me, the boardings to go up in place, and I've said, you know, how's that? And they've gone, yeah, that's all right, that's fine, there's no problem at all with the daytime images. Nighttime it can get a bit grainy, but then so did the Canon. So was it expensive? Yeah, I've probably spent about £20,000 in the last few weeks swapping over to it. I've still got a pile of Canon stuff that I need to sell. Let's see if I can get some of the money back. And I'm overdrawn this week, but that'll change. I'll get paid tomorrow for a few jobs. So, yeah, was it worth it? For the video, absolutely. Jury's out on the stills. I'm not convinced on the stills. I need to have a little look a bit further, but love, love, love the video. The FS5 is definitely a purchase you'd want. Where do you stand? Lee says, where do you stand on exporting RAW from an iPhone for retouching? Wonder if an iPhone, the quality is even worth it. I do it all the time on the 70D. Well, I used to have the 1020, the Nokia 1020, and that pushed out a DNG file, which is compressed. So you're going to get some artifacts from the compression on that anyway, although it's a lot less. That was a 34 megapixel image when it came out, and I used that to make boarding and stuff like that, and it was an absolute star. I've been published in the London Evening Standard with that image, with that camera rather. So you know, it's a good enough quality. The paper wouldn't have accepted it if it wasn't. The iPhone, I think the iPhone 6 took a good image. I've been really impressed with what I've seen on the iPhone 7 so far, although I only got it yesterday. I've only taken a few test images. But the 2x zoom thing does look to be an optical zoom. It doesn't seem to be degrading the image in the slightest, and I'm really, really impressed with what I've seen. I need to take some full pictures and then put them into a package to upscale them and see what they look like. The raw processing, I'm fine with that idea of raw processing. I always want what I can get to the best quality from a camera sensor. Bear in mind, though, that the output from Apple software is only going to be DNG, so it is compressed and it will be a smaller file size than pure RAW. So bear that in mind. But as soon as I get something where I can get it out, I'll have a go and see what it's like. Question two, green screen. Hi Ewan, I've got some questions about green screen. What is keying of green screens and how do I go about doing it in still images and video? Why is it green and not any other colour? And is there a time that you definitely wouldn't use a green screen over other techniques? Thanks, Rob. Keying. So if you go back in movie history, people have been using mats and painted mats for years. So there was a film, what was a crap film with, what's his name? Michael J. Fox, where he was the concierge. It was called The Concierge. He was a hotel concierge and he had this mat that he dropped into a frame. And when you looked at it at a certain angle, it looked like the hotel he wanted to build painted against the skyline. And mats were used and painted mats were used for years. Because of the fact you had film, if you made your mat black, then there was no light reflected off it, the film wouldn't pick up the light. So therefore, it would then be a clear piece of celluloid. And you could put what you wanted and layer that clear piece of celluloid. Now, the idea of mats then went into coloured mats in black and white. They did blue mats and yellow mats so that you do blue for the backdrop and yellow for the subject. And then you could separate the two of them and do a different thing with colouring. And then the green screen came in and you could do simple stuff with green layouts and stuff like that, and you made up these green hills and those kind of things. Now digitally you can drop any color you like out, so the keying on Final Cut Pro will actually look for green as a start off, but you can sample any color you like and it will key out that single color. You can key out black, you can key out white, you can key out blue, you can key anything you like. Blue screens were before green screens, and the reason that they used blue was it didn't need as much light to key out. It was far easier to work with, and it had higher definition of separations between the person in the front and the colour at the back. The reason they got rid of it was blue's a common colour for costumes and for uniforms and all that kind of stuff, so you didn't want to key out the person that was there, and the reason they went to green was it was a less common colour. It used a lot less light than the blue did, and it was far easier to key out in the end. So they went with it. The problem you've got with it is with blue was that you couldn't use it outdoors either, and you can use green outdoors and it doesn't cause you a problem. Would I use green screen in stills? Well, you've got to bear in mind that keying out and separation of the colouring against a green screen in photography is different from video. With video, it's far easier to key out because the software will do it for you. It'll create that alpha channel that will then separate the two. But if you look at stills, you've got to bear in mind that when you put someone against a solid colour background, you'll get some reflection of the light back onto the subject. And if you've got it too close to them, you'll end up with a slight green pallor on the skin, and then you'll start to struggle to select colours to get out. You've got the extrusion tool, that'll work really, really well. And as long as you've got a really well-lit, even backdrop and a subject which is not tainted by that colour, separation should be fairly easy. I would always shoot against white though for wanted separation, because white separates out far easier than a colour in Photoshop, I've always found. Is there a time that you definitely wouldn't use a green screen? Yeah, still photography, I'd always use a white. I'd still go for white. I'd still have an infinity curve and shoot white at a local studio or something like that. There's no way I'd go to colours. There's a video I'll put in the show notes as well on YouTube, which tells you all about the history of matting and keying in Hollywood. Have a watch of that. It's really, really good. 17 minutes long. Really, really nice. Studio lighting. Dear Ewan, I'm pretty sure I know the difference between continuous and strobe lighting, but what are the advantages and disadvantages of each, and when would you choose to use each one? So a continuous light is one that is probably LED-based now, that or fluorescent-based, that would issue a continuous stream of light to your subject, whereas strobe isn't there. You'd have a model light that would be LED or halogen that would illuminate your subject, and then when you press the shutter, you'd get a flash or a strobe from the strobe ring that was on the back of it that would reflect forward and illuminate your structure. Differences between the two. You get a lot more light with two flash head units than you ever would with two LED units. Simple as that. Unless you bought some really seriously huge, massive night sun type stuff. And they wouldn't be LED. They'd still have a halogen bulb in them. And they'd be the kind of things that you carry out on location if you were shooting a, you know, you want to fake the sun, if you like. They're kind of, I don't know, they're about 3 or 4 foot in diameter, and they've got a multitude of bulbs inside, and they're big and heavy to carry around, and you just simply wouldn't have that. So in a small home studio environment, strobes are far easier. They're cheaper to buy generally than LED continuous lighting, and they're far easier to get the light that you want. I like using strobe because that's what I was brought up with. I never had continuous light. I could only afford strobe heads. So I've got used to working about where my main strobe is, where supporting strobes are, where backlight strobes are, where I'm reflecting light using reflecting boards or a reflector, or I'm absorbing light using a blackboard or something like that to try and take the light away from a certain side of a subject. I don't do an awful lot of portraits because I'm into commercial stuff, but I do shoot good portraits. And I know about lighting, which I hope Ian would back me up on because he came and had a day with me here in the studio. Advantages and disadvantages. The light's a bit harsher with strobe to start with, unless you soften it and use, but you would, you'd always use a softbox or you'd use a diffuser or something like that on it, and you'd start bouncing the light around to reduce its intensity. It's cost really more than anything, and flexibility. If I go down to London, I can either, if I was doing stills, I could either carry one strobe or I could have to carry four continuous lighting heads. And I'd always carry the one strobe, simple as that. You can't use a strobe with video, obviously, for obvious reasons. So that doesn't work. I've got four LED continuous heads now that I carry around with me if I'm doing video down in London against a green screen. And they're brilliant. They were £2,000 though. So. Last question from Martin, who's the chairman of, or one of the senior people at Elmug. Thank you for writing this in, Martin. Ewan, I heard you talking about bokeh and depth of field during the iPhone 7 keynote, but would love an explanation of each and a practical example of how to use them both. Okay, so the way that the Apple 7 keynote laid them out, it was incredibly confusing to people who hadn't got a clue what they were listening to. They started talking about depth of field and that beautiful depth of field, and then he started mentioning bokeh. Well, they're two completely different things. Depth of field is the degree of blurring that you get between what's in focus in your shot and what's out of focus. And at the point at which you then get that blur point starting, you will get a depth of field effect. So when you at f2.8 you point it at someone's face, if you're only 2 or 3 feet away from that person, you're going to start getting differences between, you know, if you focus it on the eye, the chances are their ear is going to be out of focus, you're so close. You get further away, the f-stop setting doesn't matter so much. So if I'm out on a railway line at night and I put it down to f2.8 because I've got very low light and I shoot at something that is 50 feet away, I'll get an awful lot of stuff in focus in that, even though I'm at f2.8. Once I get up close to something, then it gets a lot more stark. And bear in mind that the amount of light that gets in through your lens is what dictates the effect, not just the f-stop that you select. That's depth of field. Bokeh is the shape of the blur. So the other thing to remember is that bokeh is put on by the lens, not by the camera. The camera's got nothing to do with it. Depth of field is to do with the camera. The effect of bokeh is to do with what the lens is seeing and the way that it patterns the out-of-focus light. So if you're in space, you've got infinite depth of field, you can set it at whatever you like and you'll get tons and tons of stuff. No problem at all with depth, no problem at all. But you can still make it out of focus by rotating the lens out of focus. And bokeh is the shape that the lens blur then makes. Okay, so this is one of the things that you'd be... So there you go, that image there is a deliberately out of focus shot at some lights in a street maybe, and the various points of light have created a bokeh effect. Now, looking at that, that's not a bad lens, but it's not a very high-end lens, I don't think, because you can see some shimmering around the outside of the circles. If you've got a really good quality lens, the circular bokeh that comes off that will be fairly uniform. I won't say sharp because that would mean it's in focus and it's not. It's definitely out of focus. But you can see on the gold one in the center, there's like a little shimmer that's come out to the side of it. So that would make me think that the lens is slightly lower quality than you'd expect, unless it's off at the side of the image or something like that and not central. If you're talking about a mixture of the two effects, well, here's a picture of a spider's web that I blatantly stole from Google. Thank you very much to whoever took it. I do apologise for stealing it. But you can see that part of the web is in focus and the back part of the web is out of the focus, that's out of focus and has droplets of water on it. Those droplets of water are then refracting or bouncing the light back towards the camera. And the shapes, the circles that are being created there, that is the bokeh. Okay? Now then, supposing you want to make bokeh that's interesting, you can actually make bokeh shapes on an image any way you like. All you have to do is cut out a cover for your lens, because it's been created in the lens. You put a cover on the lens, you deliberately blur the lens, and then whatever shape you've cut into the mat that you put on the front of the lens, it will create that bokeh shape. And here's a couple of examples, again, that I stole off Google, of people that have made cutouts that go over the front of their lens and create deliberate bokeh shapes. And this is a style of photography, creating a bokeh of different shapes. There's one there that's a spaceship, there's one that's a fish, there's one that's like a ninja star, and there's one that's like a stereotypical cat of some description. So there you go, that's it. Bokeh is pattern of blur, nothing more. Depth of field is depth of field, bokeh is bokeh. If that hasn't helped, send me another question. If you've got a question for us, send it to britishtechnetwork@gmail.com and we'll read it out. Absolutely, we'll read it out. We'll stick it in the show notes every single week and we'll answer any of your questions. I've got to say, I was really nervous before I did this. I hadn't done it for such a long time. I thought, I wonder if I can still manage it, but I've really enjoyed doing it. It's great to be back. It's great to be talking photography. We're going to have loads more reviews of gear and equipment as we come past next year, week and going on. As I said, we're going to have some special episodes. So if there's a week where I absolutely can't do a photo show, no matter what, we're going to throw in a special episode, which will hopefully be with some really good photographers talking about their gear, talking about the way that they work and all that kind of stuff. So if you've got questions for people, you know, send those in too and we can ask them of those other people. We'll be back again next week on Thursday at 11 o'clock doing the photo show, I hope. As I say, the live show might bounce around a bit, but we're aiming that we're definitely going to get it in. And if you'd like to follow Ian Lewis, he's on at ENL Photography on Twitter. Of course, he's in our Slack room as well as Ian Lewis. And thanks to him for helping out with this going forward. It's brilliant of him. See you all next week. Thanks for listening. That was cool. That was cool. I really enjoyed that. Oh, man.